Accession number 18218, Reel 1.
Roy Cleveley, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Bristol, in a district called Moorfields, one of the most poorest areas of the city, on the 28th of June, on the 29th of June, 1928.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Bristol?
Yes, indeed. The whole of my education was in the city, from infant school through to junior and final elementary and grammar.
And did you spend all the Second World War years in Bristol?
Yes, every time of it. I had the opportunity in one instance to be evacuated to America because I had relatives over there. And the ship, I think she was called the Athena, was one of the first to take many, many hundreds of children to the States. And she was, in fact, torpedoed. And if I'd agreed to have gone to Detroit, Michigan, I would probably have been on that vessel. But that I'll never know, of course.
What was your address in Bristol during the Second World War?
My address in Bristol was in Rosebery Road, Redfield, the east side of the city.
Did that area get much bombing during the Blitz?
Yes, very close shave on one blitzkrieg. We were virtually confined to an underground shelter for 13 solid hours, and the street parallel to the one I was in received a stick of bombs which took out 12 private dwelling houses, and of course there were several killed there. And being underground, I felt the sort of shock waves of each explosion, and really and truly I thought my time had come. Never experienced anything like it, although the shelter was reinforced with ironwork in the roof and pillars down below. It all sort of seemed to vibrate through that. It was a horrendous experience. That was the nearest I ever got, and I must have been about 13 at the time, 13 or 14.
So that sounds as though it was about 1941.
It was about that, when we were receiving the sort of majority of the blitzes. And from about 41 onwards, everything started to quieten down. But from 40 and 41, we had seven very, very heavy blitzes indeed.
Which particular buildings and streets do you remember being hit in your area?
Well, I can always remember my father, in some cases, because he liked to try and tune in to haw-haw crashing the BBC News. I forget what time it was then. It could have been 9 o'clock, could have been 10. He was frowned upon as being a little bit pro-German, but that wasn't the case. He was simply interested in what haw-haw had to say, because Lord haw-haw, as he was called, was in fact an Irishman that had gone to Germany and was helping in the propaganda campaign there, and obviously must have been a committed Nazi. And they used to crash, the German radio used to crash the BBC quite often for haw-haw to come through to the British people. And I can remember listening to this with my father, because haw-haw had, his mother used to live in Fishponds, which is an area of the city, so he must have known the city very well. And I can remember him literally telling us that, you know, the Luftwaffe would be visiting Bristol before too long, and started to name all the streets: Castle Street, Mary LaPorte, Denmark Street, you name them, he had them. And he said, Bristol, you will be losing your famous whatever. And in fact, on that very first blitz, the whole of the central area was taken out. It was as accurate as that.
So what was your own personal attitude towards Lord haw-haw?
Oh dear, well, of course, I mean, as a young boy, I castigated him as with all the language I could think up, I think. That's absolutely true. Yes.
How do you think public morale stood up during the Blitz in Bristol?
Incredibly well, because I think in times of danger and things of this sort, depression maybe, I really feel that the human spirit tends to rally and coalesce, if I can make that expression. And I do feel that the citizens of Bristol, and of course very much divided politically in all shades, really did come together. And there was tremendous self-help and mutual help that occurred. And I think this helped us tremendously to get through those very dangerous times.
Did you lose any relatives or friends in the bombing?
No, I didn't, fortunately. But I knew a friend of mine actually lost a friend in that blitz on the that I just described, when they took the 12 houses out. He and his father were killed because I think they were doing ARP watch duty at the time and standing out in the street. So, no, I didn't lose anyone personally, thankfully.
What did you think of the work of the emergency services?
Extremely good. They were controlled by the local authority with numerous, what we called ARP ambulances. They were only little covered vehicles, actually, little 1,500-weight vans. Used to go about either taking stirrup pumps and all the equipment necessary, rushing extra stuff to a particular place, and of course as well as picking up the wounded and the dead.
What do you think was the attitude towards the German pilots who were carrying out the bombing?
Well, that varied, I think. I never really heard anyone sort of only sort of to clap and to rejoice when in fact we heard of an aircraft being shot down. I've got a very funny story about that, because I had an uncle in those days that actually worked on those ambulances, and we had a Messerschmitt 110 shot down after a night raid in the grounds of one of the hospitals at Fishponds. And of course there was a lot of debris scattered about in the wreckage, and it was cordoned off. And my uncle knew that as a lad I was collecting shrapnel from the gutter and all sorts of things, rather like we used to exchange picture cards later on. We at school would change, oh, I've got a bit of German, we never knew what it was, but it looked like German bomb shrapnel, and we would interchange our stuff. And I had quite a formidable collection of all this. And my uncle stayed with us because he had his own roof blown off up at Brislington, and because we had a rather large house then, we could accommodate just he and his wife for a short time until their house was repaired. And he knew that, of course, I was very, very keen on collecting all this. And I said, did he not know that this aircraft had been shot down? And he said, yes. He didn't say any more. But unknown to me, obviously, he was visiting this very place on duty. And he had the nerve. He was one of those. It always sort of said, okay, you know, I'm a uniformed person, which he was, got into this place, into this cordoned off area, and brought me back a wonderful piece of the Messerschmitt's engine with all the cogs mashed into each other and a little bit of oil or fuel-stained parachute. And I kept that for years and years and years. And the funny story about this is that later on in life, not too long ago, it was my 65th birthday, I had a book given me called Felton Bombed, right? And in that book, I've got it upstairs, you can see it for yourself. In that book is a picture of a Messerschmitt 110 with the crew of two named underneath in the caption. And the caption went on to say that this very aircraft was shot down over Bristol, over Felton, within a few days of this photograph being taken. And as I had their names, I made some inquiries, and the youngest was 19, and I think the oldest was about 23, 24. The pilot was 24, I think the young one was either the navigator or the gunner. And one died immediately, and the other died about 4 days later on. And so I made some inquiries at the local cemetery and found where their graves were, and have actually stood in front of them, in front of their headstones. And that's the same bit of aircraft that I possessed for all those years, long since gone, of course. So that was a great coincidence of life.
So you said how your father listened to Lord Haw Haw on the wireless.
Mm-hmm.
Did the family also listen to Churchill's speeches?
Oh, yes, of course. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we wouldn't miss any of those. The point being, of course, that I suppose we wanted to see both sides of the story and how the war was progressing. And it was obvious that we knew that the German propaganda was, in fact, just that. And a great deal of it was false. But on the occasion that Bristol caught it, it was absolutely true. He did exactly what he said the Luftwaffe would do, and it later came to mind that the Germans were in fact flying over this city, and probably many others too, certainly London, as early as 1936-37, on the pretext of I don't know, maybe passenger flights, but they were also aerial photographing, and there are records of those photographs of the city, very well defined. So they knew what they were about even before the war started, as such.
What effect did the speeches of Churchill have?
Oh, they were tremendously uplifting, and I mean, the man gave us tremendous hope. I think that was the operative thing. It maybe we used to doubt him sometimes and think, well, how can it be? You know, we've just lost this and so many prisoners have been taken by the Germans. Yet another country has fallen. But at the end of the day, we had this tremendous faith in what he was telling us and confidence in the government of the time, which was a coalition, I understand.
What was it like for you as a schoolboy in Bristol in the Second World War?
It was exciting. I've got to say, I'm not sure whether, in fact, we realised the extent of the danger. I certainly did during that night in the shelter. But we used to go about our usual daily life. We used to play in the streets and get up to all kinds of pretty innocent mischief. But nevertheless, we used to enjoy ourselves, play hard, and still stay at school. I mean, even that 13-hour situation, I can remember, we were given, I think, a half day off the following morning, just sent back and said, well, don't bother, but come in at 2 o'clock. And there was very, very little schooling lost in that sense. Extremely good.
So your education wasn't affected?
Well, not really. Obviously, we did feel pretty bleary-eyed on some occasions in class. So whether that, you know, without that, we would have been better students in later years, I can't say. But we also have very good teachers, of course, that were just as sterling in their attempts to keep things going, you know.
Was there ever any question of your being evacuated, apart from that American business you mentioned?
Yes. There was a general evacuation of the city. A lot of them went to Devon and Cornwall, I understand. A very close friend of mine was one of them. We were school classmates together. And I was given the opportunity, and being an only child, I just said to my parents, I feel I wanted to stay. And they said, why? Well, don't be silly, you know. You'll be out of all this this dangerous city. And I said, no, I do feel I want to stay. And stay I did.
What made you say that?
I just don't know. It's the fact that I must have had a quiet sort of confidence that we were going to be okay. We were going to get through things. And it was just a child's mind to not want to be sent away, I suppose. We were in one unknown situation. I didn't want to go into another, particularly at that time.
What did you think throughout the war of England's prospects in it?
Very poor in the beginning, because even as a boy, for some reason or other, I got very, very interested in it early on. And I did obtain maps of the war fronts, with the respective flags of the nations, and I used to try as best I could to keep track of the front of the fronts, the various fronts. And when in fact, you know, we were getting this tremendous push back and forwards in the Middle East, for example, it was a very sad time. And I could never really see ourselves conquering such a tremendous war machine. And I think one had to accept it, I certainly have in later years, that the German war machine was had bound to be the strongest in the world at that particular time. And until America came in, which I think gave us some psychological confidence, if nothing else, I think we did sort of go through some very dark days. Very dark days indeed.
What about rationing? Did you ever go without foods that you wanted?
Yes, particularly sweets, I suppose. They suddenly disappeared, and although I had encountered a banana, for example, before they were non-existent, we did miss things like that, the beautiful Jaffa oranges and things of this sort. But of course, I mean, there again, a family usually cooperated so well that you would get one or two adults sacrificing maybe their sugar so that somebody else who was maybe, you know, quite a sweet tooth could have that share or part of it. And this is how we got through things. Yeah.
Did you ever come across anybody whose morale was poor or whose faith in continuing the war had cracked?
Yes, yes. There was one particular lady, and I'm a devil at remembering names, but her name's just come back to me now, immediately. Mrs. Berridge. And she had an only boy, and she was one of the 12 or so of us that shared this underground shelter. And she lived just opposite my house. And we all knew that her son had become a bomber crew, and he was shot down and killed over Germany, and that was terrible. She would come into the shelter with the young widow, hadn't been married all that long, and you know, we were all lost for words, and that was a terribly depressing time.
What happened in Bristol at the end of the war?
Well, at the end of the war, immediately, of course, there was great rejoicing. City went crazy, and flags everywhere, and dancing, and all that sort of thing. And then we sort of started to get down into a kind of quiet routine. But amazingly enough, you know, this city was very, very lax in clearing and restoring its bomb sites, and there were many, many of them. And it's only until quite recently, the last less than a decade, that the last ones were actually built upon or made into parks or something of this sort. Dozens of sites were left very, very derelict. And of course, the city council came in for some hammering on this over the years. But I think eventually we have rebuilt most of the damage now. It took a long time, awful long time.
Now, how did you come to be in the forces yourself?
Well, of course, national service was in fact statutory then, and when you reached the age of 18, you were eligible to be called to the colours. And I can remember registering. We all had to register on our 18th birthday, registering at Nelson Street, just off the city centre. And my preference at the time was for the Navy, because I love the sea, and I still do. And I've never been seasick in my life. And I've been in some horrendous waters, actually. But anyway, it's another story. They told me that, the Navy, that was being run down. Their ships were being cocooned, put into reserve, and many of the naval people were, in fact, being offered a transfer into other forces, particularly the Army. And so I said, well, in that case, unless I signed up for a number of years, which I didn't particularly want to do. So I cut my losses and accepted the Royal Air Force.
What date was this?
This was, when I was called up.
Yes.
I was called up in about mid-July. I think it was the 16th of July 1946.
All right, that's near enough. Don't worry with documents at this stage. Just go from memory, please. So what was the next step for you?
Well, my next step was to report to Royal Air Force Padgate in Warrington, there to be kitted out in uniform and all the other paraphernalia we had to carry about, kit bags and the rest of it. That took about a week to 10 days, I suppose. And of course it was my very first journey alone on a train away from the city.
Where did you do your basic training?
From there I was sent to RAF Yatesbury in Wiltshire, just 30 miles away from the city here, where in fact I discovered later that my own Bishop of Bristol, Barry Rogerson, had trained as well, but in a different respect, and many, many years later, of course. And I did square bashing, as it was known then, there for about 8 to 9 weeks.
What was the basic training like?
Oh, it was pretty severe, but by golly, did it ever get us fit. I never felt fitter in all my life. I was at my right weight, which I've never regained since, and felt as fit as a fiddle. We used to have to do road runs before breakfast up onto the Wiltshire Downs to reach the White Horse, the famous White Horse. And we were booked in by somebody that had already got there before us. And those that didn't reach it either had very reduced breakfast or they were told to do it again. So, you know, your good breakfast depended on reaching the White Horse or sitting on it somewhere.
How were you treated by the people in charge of the basic training?
Oh, very good. I can always remember the corporal NCO that, in fact, was our drill instructor. They were called DIs. And he was so, in his demeanour, the way he used to sort of drill us the clicking of his boots on the gravel on the parade ground, it still stays with me. And he was so perfect that he wasn't a very tall man, but had he been tall, I think he would have been a guardsman without a shadow of a doubt. He was excellent, and we all passed out extremely good. I understand one of the best flights. I think they tell that to everybody, but I think we were told it was one of the best flights that had gone through for some months before.
The reason I ask is because we hear so much on the media nowadays about abusive behaviour by people in charge of recruits.
Yeah, non-existent. It was literally non-existent. Oh, you would have the odd chiding in the ranks. Someone maybe with a top button left undone, or the hat badge not properly aligned. There'd be some sarcastic remarks, but nothing physical whatsoever. And you know, by then, having come through the war as younger people, I think we were well sort of attuned to take that sort of thing.
And after basic training, where did you go then?
Basic training, I was sent then to, well, I went to a holding unit because the course that I was assigned to at RAF Cranwell was in fact full, and they hadn't passed through to allow enough accommodation for the next lot. So I was in a holding unit at 16 MU Stafford, a huge maintenance unit, one of the largest in the Midlands. And there I met lots of chaps just beginning to be demobbed and come out of the services. And of course they'd all been through the war. They were literally veterans at that stage. So we had a little bit of chiding from them because we had to share the billets with quite a few of them, and they would say, you know, you don't know what you're in for, but you won't be dodging bullets every 5 minutes. Things of this sort used to come our way, and it was very well-meaning flack, but we had to take it. Yes.
And after Stafford?
After Stafford, over to Lincolnshire, RAF Cranwell, and that was in the later part of 1946, almost all mid to late autumn, I would imagine. And there I did a radio telephony course in the radio school there, which was situated extremely close to the famous college, beautiful place, beautiful building. the Royal Air Force College at Cranwell. And that was radio telephony dealing with air-to-ground communication in cooperation with radar services, the orientation of aircraft and whatever.
What were living conditions like at Cranwell?
Well, they were very good. In fact, it almost resembled an extension of the training. And, of course, in a training situation, everything's got to be perfect, perfectly clean, everything folded to size and put in its right place. And this was very, very similar, except that there was a relaxation on kit inspections because, of course, we were studying then and we were going through classes and so forth. But I remember then that we also experienced the horrendous winter of 1946-47, and that's remembered by everyone that experienced it in those times. And Lincolnshire had exceptionally heavy snowfalls. So some of the little byroads had 15 to 20 foot drifts, you know, and eventually. Coal, which of course we depended on coal a great deal then, the trains just could not get through to the camp, and therefore we couldn't sustain our heating. And I can remember actually having to try and wash and shave in not only cold water, almost icicles, because you could see that, you know, the freezing aspect was setting in, and it became so severe that they gave us snow leave. Now I ask you, snow leave? Things couldn't get in. Now, how did they expect us to get out? But, in fact, we did. And I got a nice 14 days leave back in Bristol, still in iced up conditions. I can remember Bristol being heavily sort of iced up here. And, of course, returned eventually and finished the course. But that had to be believed to experience that awful winter of 46 into 47, well into 47, because it went on until almost the mid-March, I understand.
So what rank and job did you have by the time you'd finished that course?
Well, I just still an AC2, which was an AC plonk, as they called us, but I had qualified. I was then a radio telephony operator, air to ground, not knowing precisely where I was going from there.
Where did you go?
And in fact, I was given excitedly 14 days leave, and on inquiring why such a nice bit of leave, I was told, well, it's embarkation, which meant at least we were going somewhere abroad. And I thought this might be Germany, but no, it wasn't. It was Malaya. So after the 14 days embarkation, we went under canvas at a former United States Air Force base. I can't quite recall the name of it, but we went under canvas for about a week and then trained it down from, I think that was again around Warrington Way, trained it down to Southampton. And this troop train actually passed through my local station at Lawrence Hill, where I was living then, of course, that area, just about a half a mile away from home.